I'll have what she's having.
Thank you for tuning in to the Our Better Half podcast. This is episode 12, April 3rd, 2016. Our guest today will be Dr. Alan Altman to talk about the Hot Flash Havoc documentary. Is this sound familiar? How about this one? Is there a woman in the world who welcomes the sound of that hard paper liner and the foot stirrups coming out of the examining table? Yes, I went to my gynecologist recently. It is not my idea of a good time to get upended and pried open in a bright room, but it is almost amusing when you're holding a microphone, I found out. Anything for you, dear listeners. I won't get into the details of my consult, but I will report that my bits and bobs are all in good order, and I left with good advice on several topics. What did not come up, notably, was hormone replacement, which is the topic today. I am, by inclination, all for the natural. Natural childbirth preferred, slow to pop a pill, embracing my gray hair, not spending any money on age-defying skin creams. So the very idea of hormone replacement is a hard sell for me. When some years ago trials of hormone replacement therapies for menopausal women were abruptly stopped when they became associated with increased cancer and did not seem to help with heart disease, I confess I was one of the I told you so chorus. Don't mess with Mother Nature. Believe me when I say I'm not telling folks what to think about hormone replacement. I know people for whom hormone replacement was really life-changing and important. If nothing else, I believe each of us needs to make our own assessment of medical information and research, and those decisions are personal and private, but also important. Full disclosure, I myself do not take hormones except for a brief flirtation with yam ointment 10 years back. I saw press on this documentary, Hot Flash Havoc, a while ago. It advertises a humorous and honest look at the change. The narrator is Goldie Hawn. The graphics are psychedelic. And some of the stories are harrowing. It is a bleak view of menopause. As I watched it, granola valley curmudgeon that I am, I thought it was cute, but transparently a pharmaceutical boondoggle appealing to women's worst fears. I think it portrays menopause as a disability and drugs as the fountain of youth. The promise of physical comfort and good sex and fresh young skin are only bolstered by the promise of unseen benefits to the heart and bones, and that some of the worst stereotypes of women's emotions and vanities are played on in this documentary. But I wish they weren't, because we really do need to have a conversation about what these significantly longer lives we're living really mean. Lives that are now possible thanks to safer childbirth and antibiotics and healthier lifestyles for those living in the first world, with access to healthcare and safe water and food with no bullets flying overhead. When I asked for the interview for this documentary, which is now running on public TV in the U.S., I expected to be sold the drugs as answer party line, and I expected to leave it the same as I arrived, skeptical. What I got with Dr. Alan Altman, consultative gynecologist for menopause and sexual dysfunction, was a more thoughtful discussion. It made me think. I ended the conversation with as many questions as when I'd started. I readily confess I'm undecided on the topic and realize this is something with strong feelings all around. I think it's something we need to talk about, though, as we plan our second half. So, here is my conversation with Dr. Altman. Hello, Dr. Altman.
Well, hi there.
Thank you for this interview. I'm looking forward to speaking with you.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you for having me.
I have read that one of your patients, one who was looking for a female gynecologist, said after she met you that you were a female gynecologist. What makes a good gynecologist?
Well, first of all, I take that very, very highly. It was a wonderful statement. And what she meant was you were somebody who is willing to sit and listen, willing to understand what she was saying, being empathetic, and teaching and explaining so that everything was clear. And, you know, there's this semi-division between male and female gynecologists. I would sometimes hear patients say, oh, I want to go to a female gynecologist. Well, you know, a cardiologist doesn't have to have had a heart attack in order to be able to treat heart problems. Same thing with an oncologist, doesn't need to have cancer to be able to treat cancer. So it's there's a femaleness that's beneficial as opposed to a maleness, and I think that's what she was getting at.
I thought it was very sweet. You have a strong interest in the topic of menopause and sexual functioning for women as they age. And you were a consultant for the documentary Hot Flash Havoc, which I've watched. It takes a very funny but pointed view of menopause. What's the funniest menopause story you remember over your years of consulting with women?
The funniest menopause story has to be preceded by saying there's nothing really funny about some of the real major annoyances and serious problems with menopause that not every woman goes through. But I think they're probably more involved around the sexual part of menopause. Mm-hmm. And to be very frank with you and very honest, the one that comes to mind, which was said by a patient, which has to do with, well, I'll let the listeners decide what it has to do with. I said, are you sexually active? And she said, well, Dr. A, my husband and I having sex is kind of like trying to put a raw oyster into a slot machine. And it just pointed out very clearly the essence of the kinds of problems couples have postmenopausally, having to do with erectile dysfunction, which is almost a natural occurrence as men age, and also with vaginal dryness and vaginal atrophy and pain with sex, which is also a natural occurrence without estrogen as women age way beyond the menopause. So there's always humor in it, and there is also a serious meaning to it.
Mm. Well, this podcast is about sex over 50 in the second half of life, and most of us over 50 have been there or are going to in terms of menopause. Are there any upsides to menopause?
Are there any what? I'm sorry?
Upsides.
Well, first of all, if you live long enough, you will have your final menstrual period, so that's a good sign. Menopause itself is a very natural transition in a woman's lifetime. It's certainly not a disease, and we shouldn't be treating it as a disease. However, what is relatively unnatural, at least to our species over the last 100 years, is that women are now outliving their ovaries by 3, 4, 5, maybe even 6 decades by the time we get there. And when the ovaries stop producing the natural estrogen, estradiol, there are consequences 20, 30, and 40 years later from the loss of that estrogen, even though the annoyances that occur initially are symptoms that really can't kill you. They can annoy you, but then it turns in more to systemic problems and long-term problems with time. So the longer the time is there, the more consequences menopause can have.
A lot of women, including myself, experience menopause without much of a pause, as it were. How often is menopause a big deal?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. Menopause is an annoying big deal for probably 80 to 90% of women in the beginning because they go through something called estrogen withdrawal, and that is the drop in the natural level of estrogen. During the perimenopausal transition, there is erratic function of the ovaries, so the estrogen levels go up and down, you know, with no set form to it. But postmenopausally, those levels drop. And the annoyances that one gets from that, hot flashes, night sweats, sleeplessness, palpitations, headaches, mood changes, quite frankly, if you leave them alone long enough, they will begin to dissipate because the body stops withdrawing. It's the longer term problems that make it what it is. Now, for someone like you and those with you who haven't had very much in the way of symptoms, you would often be called the asymptomatic postmenopausal woman, but I would offer to you that there is no such thing as that. And the reason is that there are things going on in your bones, in your heart, in your brain, in your joints that you don't feel, that are not symptomatic, but with time, you will begin to notice those changes. And this was brought to an analogy that I think is really perfect, although it's a little crude, but the analogy brought to me by a patient was, gee, when I bought my house, it looked great. It was wonderful. We lived in it for 15 years. Nobody knew that there were termites in the basement and the foundation. And now 15 years later, the house is starting to fall apart. So the asymptomatic postmenopausal woman really is not asymptomatic from the point of view of what's happening in the body, both as she ages, which is normal aging, and also as that estrogen level stays low with the aging. So there are two impacts on the curve involved with the rest of your life and your health.
And those changes, those possibly not symptomatic or visibly symptomatic problems, are you arguing that they need to be treated?
Well, I'm saying that women need to look at a long-term picture with respect to their health, their quality of life. So what can one do if one knows that the majority of the population who is 10 or 15 years postmenopausal, who is not on estrogen, what can they do to forego some of these chronic problems? Well, your diet, your weight, your mental functioning and mental exercising, your physical exercise, weight-bearing exercise, all of these things can have an impact on bone, on cardiovascular system, on the brain, on cognitive functioning and memory. That's without estrogen. What the studies have shown us, the dementia studies, the osteoporosis studies, the cardiovascular studies, is that when you keep the estrogen there postmenopausally, you enhance the potentiality for these problems to be kept away, or at least kept at bay. With aging, there's a normal increase in risk of heart attack and stroke and problems like that, and osteoporosis, osteoporotic fracture. By the way, needless to say, more women die each year from complications of osteoporotic fracture than die from breast cancer in this country. And that's a little known fact that's extremely important. So what the point here is that with time, these risks go up. We've got numerous studies, including WHI, when you look at the appropriate age group in the Women's Health Initiative. And all of these studies show that when you start hormonal therapy postmenopausally, less than the age of 60 and within 10 years of your final menstrual period, you very clearly cut your future risk of heart disease by 30%. And you also cut your future risk of what we call total mortality, which means dying from any cause at all, by 30 to 40%. So that's the kind of data and information under which a woman can make an intelligent decision about hormones and menopause and postmenopausal life, as opposed to making these decisions based on fear because they were told 14 years ago that estrogen is not good for you and it causes these problems. It doesn't help prevent them. But we've shown that that was clearly a misrepresentation. And really, that's what Hot Flash Havoc the movie is about, this misrepresentation, and how it frightened so many millions of women into throwing their hormones down the toilet, and the impact that that had on a number of these women. And it goes a long way in correcting the misrepresentation from that study. You know, recent studies really do confirm that estrogen can help prevent heart disease, dementia, and osteoporosis.
You have been a vocal critic of the WHI, the Women's Health Initiative study. So why would that have gone so wrong? What were the motives? And why do you think that that went so wrong?
Well, that's an excellent question. And it actually was a very decent study if it was presented properly. You see, WHI looked at women in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Those are very different kinds of organisms. Women in their 50s are very different from women in their 70s. Estrogen, which we've known for some time, first of all, is not just a reproductive hormone. It's a hormone involved in multiple systems in a woman's body, and it's very important. And we also know that estrogen is a preserver of good function. It's not a repairer of bad function. So when generally speaking, the good function is there in the 50s. For instance, the coronary arteries are a lot cleaner when a woman is in her 50s than when a woman is in her 70s. So estrogen can help preserve that good function, whereas if a woman in her 70s with coronary plaque takes estrogen orally, she increases the risk that a blood clot will get into that coronary artery, which is already narrowed, and shut it down and cause a heart attack. So you really have three different kinds of study subjects at 50, 60, 70. Quite frankly, we were given the first WHI, and I think there are close to 160 papers now from that huge study. And when we read that first paper, most of us in menopausal medicine were quite pleased because it showed that the women who took it at the appropriate time in their 50s got these benefits. Unfortunately, and this is a long-winded answer to your question, where did it go wrong? They presented the initial paper at a press conference where they simply took the results from all the women. They did not stratify or separate the data. And that is utterly misleading, especially when it comes to hormones.
So
not only that, but as it turns out, in the estrogen-only arm of the WHI study, which was the women who had had hysterectomy previously, so they only took estrogen without progestin, there was a statistically significant decreased risk of breast cancer.
Okay.
Little reported.
Let me ask you then. I come from many women our age come from an era of, you know, we don't want to take medicine. We want to do things the natural way. And the WHI study seemed to rebuke the use of medicine, as you've said. So what was, I think people can easily say, well, there's a motive for pharmaceutical companies to want to sell hormones. What's the motive for the government and other people to say that we shouldn't be taking them if they are healthy for some women?
Well, if the NIH would have hired me or still would hire me as their PR agent, I would say the following. I would say that we are basically given the job of making sure women are safe making sure that products that women use and information that women are given is not harmful to them. So we were charged with this study to figure out if indeed estrogen should be used to help prevent chronic disease. And because we're charged with making sure women stay safe, we initially reported this study in a way that frightened women, but we meant to do that because the bit of information that we got at first was concerning. Now, some will say we overreacted, but actually, we're charged with that duty of keeping women safe. Now, however, 12 years later, 14 years later, if I could have said this 2 years ago, we realize that we may have overreacted because these are the results that actually have come down now, and we can say them pretty clearly. But because we get concerned about women's safety, that's why we reacted in the first place like that. So please forgive us. Now, what was the internal motive? The internal motive was that people at the NIH and public health officials were starting to see that clinicians, both internists, family practice, gynecologists, were using postmenopausal estrogen to prevent the risk of heart disease because that's what data showed, and it still shows that today. So they set out to show that we got to see whether that really is the case. And let me give you the best example of their bias, and it's really a short statement here. The increase in relative risk of breast cancer in the combined arm, the estrogen-progestin arm, was 1.26. And there was no statistical significance to that. And so the people in the study said there is an increased risk of breast cancer, even though it didn't meet significance, which meant it could have come from chance. But nonetheless, they called that an increased risk. In the estrogen-only arm of the study, there was a 1.24 decrease risk that was statistically significant. What did the WHI people call it? No increase risk. So where there's an increase that wasn't significant, they called it an increase. Where there's a decrease that was significant, they called it no increase. They couldn't possibly get out of their mouths that it was a decreased risk. So that's where you see the bias that entered into it. And that's the concern we had. But I must tell you, we've resisted the WHI the way it was initially presented from the day it was presented. And we've been working very hard. When I say we, I mean probably the 20 top thought leaders on menopause in the country who lecture to doctors and nurse practitioners throughout the country. The data is extremely strong. We've continued this fight to get the information right. And we are right, as has been shown with numerous studies since WHI. But then the pièce de résistance, the main author and leader of the WHI study, Joanne Manson, who was a colleague of mine when I was at Harvard Medical School for 35 years, just co-authored a paper that the medical profession had overreacted and wrongly interpreted the WHI data and frighten women from using any kind of estrogen. Can you imagine that? And she was the essence of why so many millions of women were frightened. So I think that's probably as close to an admission of, gee, we're sorry, we shouldn't have frightened women this way, but again, we're charged with making sure women stay safe. So that's the closest I suspect we'll get.
So people are going to wonder, so I do need to ask this, whether you accept income from hormone replacement manufacturers.
Could you repeat that, please?
Do you accept income from pharmaceuticals that...
Oh, no. I used to lecture for a lot of institutions, medical centers, grand rounds and things like that. And at that time, I also did some speaking for any kind of estrogen that was non-oral, because we have moved on from using estrogen pills to using patches and gels and vaginal rings, because it's a much safer way to take estrogen. So that's the essence of why I agreed to talk for a number of pharmaceutical companies way back then, to get clinicians to be aware of transdermal versus oral estrogen. At the present time, I don't. I just do speaking engagements around the world for academic medical centers and conferences.
How about the documentary? Was it funded?
No, we're very proud to say there's not a penny of pharmaceutical money in this documentary, and we're very proud of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can go to hotflashhavoc.com, to the website, not only to get the actual movie, the actual DVD, which is longer than the cut one that is in PBS fundraising right now, but most importantly, on that website, you can also get a set of five DVDs, which has seven doctors and nurse practitioners who are the major experts in their specific area of expertise. Each one of these DVDs is almost like having a private consultation with these experts, because we ask them questions that are commonly asked to their subspecialties. So there's one on heart by the foremost cardiologist of female cardiology in the country. There's one on bone by the same level of expert around the world. There's one on sex that I'm involved with Cheryl Kingsberg, who's both of us have been the head of these, the president and past president of the Sexual Medicine Society internationally. There's one on menopausal symptoms, one on lifestyle changes, and one on the symptoms of menopause. These are incredible additions to the movie, because you can actually get the answers to questions from these experts. Even if you could afford it, for heaven's sakes, you couldn't get these seven experts together and get these kinds of discussions going. So I really do recommend it. It's also pharmaceutically free, no money from pharma at all.
If your sister, I don't know if you have one, but if your sister was going through menopause, what advice would you have for her for keeping her sense of humor and her sex life and protecting her age as she gets older?
Well, not only my sister, but my wife, who had her natural menopause at the age of 36, which is on the early side. So hopefully she's going to live 5 to 6 decades after her menopause. The advice I would have would be, and this is actually advice from some of the women in the movie, first of all, be proactive. Be the worried well, which is the majority of who we are at this point, and understand the changes that happen normally with aging. Understand the things that you can do that make sense to help stay healthy as you age. Keep a good sense of humor. Keep a positive state of mind. Really understand that your diet is important. Really understand, you know, we give lip service to exercise. My wife and I moved to Aspen, Colorado, simply because it's one of the healthiest places on earth, where we are constantly active. It begets longevity here. So if you are proactive, you keep a sense of humor, you read, you understand, you follow things that are happening in the health and the medical community, but also in the mental health community, because the brain is so important in this as well. Use it or lose it. And that's not just sex. It's got to do with brain function. It's got to do with your joints, your muscle function, your ability to get around. That's what I would say to my sister or my wife. And you know, have a good partner. Have a good partner with you. I think that's very important. And Lucy, my little puggle, would say that Also, having a great companion of a dog, a puppy around, helps you actually live longer and live more happily.
Mm. Well, thank you very, very much, Dr. Altman. I appreciate your time and all the answers that you've given.
You're very welcome. I appreciate your having me on, and I hope this information has been helpful to your audience.
It's time for our Kegel break. I know you're working hard on this, my friends, and your pelvic floor thanks you. But how well are we doing? The voice you hear is Tatiana Kozevnikova, a 42-year-old Russian woman with the world's strongest vagina. She lifted 31 pounds, 14 kilograms, to win that title. And yes, you can watch it on YouTube, and I have a link on the site. And yes, it is strangely PG, but seriously, we need to get to work.
I've been through the mill of love. Oh, love. New love.
We have Alberta Knish here, our senior correspondent of old sex, with part two from last week's episode about very, very old dildos. What are we going to talk about today?
Hello, Laura. And I think that today we're going to go on to the natural evolution. If you have something that looks like a penis and is fun, let's see if we could make it move around, and then it might be a little bit more fun. So we are going to talk about the development of the vibrator. And first, Laura, I want to find out if you've had an hysterical paroxysm today.
It's early in the day, so no.
Well, there's some people who might want to wake up with one. A hysterical paroxysm is what the ancient Greek and then later Western medicine texts termed a woman's orgasm. Hysteria coming from the Greek word for the woman's uterus, and paroxysm just meaning spasm. I just love this idea. I think it's a terrific notion that it is critical to a woman's health to be experiencing regular hysterical paroxysms.
I love it.
And it's an incredibly feminist idea, and yet somehow for the bulk of its existence, the way it's been put into play has not necessarily been. So the idea that the ancient Greeks had was that, as I mentioned with the dildos, is that it was very important for women, if the uterus wasn't exercised on a regular basis and there weren't orgasms on a regular basis, that health problems and mood problems would ensue. The thing to relieve it was dildos. However, I think people who have used sex toys find the ones that vibrate impart more exciting sensations. So the quest for the vibrator became an early thing before machines and before batteries. And the very first vibrator that is mentioned is alleged to have been invented by none other than Cleopatra, that siren of antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
What Cleopatra is alleged to have done, and mind you, I have scoured the record, cannot find where the origin of this story is, or who said it, where it's attributed from. But the story exists that what she did was take a kind of gourd called a calabash, which is kind of bulbous on one end and then has a long protuberance, which is rather penile-shaped in the other, and had it stuffed with angry bees so that it would vibrate.
Oh, my God.
all I can say is if this woman actually went near her hoo-ha with a gourd full of angry bees, that makes her the most BAMF person, the most metal woman that ever existed.
Oh, wow. That's hard-edged there. Yeah. Okay, this begs a question.
Yes.
Penises don't vibrate. So
no, but they do move. And actually, if you look up the Kama Sutra and other how-to texts, there's a lot of instruction for men about how to make small twitchy movements for her pleasure with their penis. So I think that's vibrating or moving mechanically in and out are two of the options that people have figured out to do with dildos. Now, from Cleopatra's time into about the 1700s, people pretty much were just stuck with whatever they could do for dildos. However, in this era of sexual repression that comes out in the 1700s, 1800s, we start seeing more in the medical literature about the resurgence of this ancient Greek idea that women's problems were caused by hysteria, which was due to not enough orgasms. And what would happen, and we have to assume that these would mostly be upper-class women with access to their, you know, to regular care and a home physician, is they would be prescribed orgasms. However, the cultural mores were like, you know, sex wasn't supposed to be for pleasure. It was supposed to be for for a woman's pleasure. It was supposed to be for men's pleasure, for procreation. Think of the king and all of that stuff. So the solution around this is to go to the doctor and have the doctor manually manipulate you to orgasm.
So your doctor was the vibrator.
Your doctor would hands-on, and what winds up coming up is doctors who are doing this in their private practice, it's taking a lot of time. Their female patients keep coming in for the treatment, and they start complaining that it's making their hands tired and taking too much time out of their practice. So it is doctors who started the next big quest onto how to make a dildo that moved, so that they wouldn't have to do this in their office. And they came up with all kinds of things. A steam vibrator was invented in the 1850s. There was a crank model that could be used that kind of cranked in and out. As soon as electricity becomes available in upper middle class and wealthy homes, there's the first plug-in vibrator shows up in the early 1910s.
I was a brave first woman to try that one out.
The 1900 Paris Expo had more than a dozen medical vibrators. If you live in the Bay Area in San Francisco, you are lucky enough to have a museum dedicated to the vibrator. And you can see they have collected these things, and they will show you how they work. And it is just fascinating to go through it and to look at these things and to kind of wonder how in the world. There was obviously a market for it, and it was done under clinical pretext, but exactly how did these materials come around, and who are these people who were deluding themselves into saying, all right, I'm really only doing this for medicine so that these poor doctors can relieve their tired hands? I can't get over that idea.
So many questions. Well, thank you very much for that. We will have all of this in the show notes, and I guess we'll have to have a field trip to that museum. What's the name of the museum?
The Antique Vibrator Museum. Good Vibrations Antique Vibrator Museum, a historical sexual treasure. Oh, you have to see the things in here, Laura. The slideshow is just brilliant.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much, Alberto. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
So why do I like to read out notable decennial birthdays. I'm making the point that people have sex over 50, over 60, over 70, and beyond. Not that they have to, but they can if they want to, and it shouldn't be a taboo topic. So many interesting people could start getting busy over 50 in March 2016. Having sex over 90? Alan Greenspan, the economist. Andre Wajda, the film director. Jerry Lewis, the comic. Martin Shubik, the economist. Darren Foe, the playwright. And Ingvar Kamprad, the founder of IKEA. I have to note that Antonin Scalia almost made it to sex over 80. He was 1 month short when he died this month. Sepp Blatter, the FIFA president, did make it. Harald Zurhausen, the scientist who discovered the role of the papillomavirus. Alec Boxenberg, the astronomer. And F.W. de Klerk, head of state for South Africa. Ursula Andress, the actor. Ed Broadbent, the Canadian politician. Mario Vargas Llosa, the novelist from Peru. Having sex over 70. Liza Minnelli. Judy Zebra Knight, who claims to channel Ramtha, a Lemurian warrior who fought the Atlanteans over 35,000 years ago. Ruth Poynter of the Poynter Sisters, and Menachem Keller, my Momidian scholar. Turning 60, Bryan Cranston, the actor from Breaking Bad. Karen Finley, a yam-slathering performance artist. Shashi Tharoor, the UN Undersecretary General. Joey Buttafuoco, the criminal. Rob Paulsen, who was the voice of Ninja Turtle Raphael. Dana Delaney, the actor from China Beach. Ingemar Stenmark, the skier. Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft. And now, having sex over 50, Don Lemon, the journalist from CNN. Tone Loke, also known as Anthony Terrell Smith. Asif Manvi, the actor. Edie Brickell, the singer. Fatima Binte Abdul Latif, the Singaporean politician. And Joan Sisiati Tahafa Viliamu, Nguyen politician and cabinet minister. Congratulations. It's time to say goodbye and to look forward to next week's podcast, when we will meet a gentleman who wrote Orgasms, 101 Facts and Trivia, plus other guests.
I'm a great believer that everybody should try and average one orgasm a day.
A day? And
especially once you turn 50 in the second half of your life.
Thank you for your support, my friends. One request. I want you to tape a question for our Explain That to a Grandma segment. Think of a short question about modern sex that you would want someone young to explain to you. It can be serious or silly. The idea is to get people talking across generations about sex and relationships. Email me at laura@ourbetterhalf.net with questions or ideas. And if you have a question about sex, I'm happy to find an expert or a young person to answer it, because I don't know anything, but I'm good at finding those who do. Now, off with you old people. I know you're busy getting rid of hair you didn't want and hiding the hair you've involuntarily lost, but make sure not to end your day without at least one orgasm. Not for nothing, but we can tell when you don't.